Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Take Aim, Accuracy in Media's weekly talk show on Blog Talk Radio. AIM is America's original media watchdog, and every week we point out biased coverage and bring you the stories the mainstream media ignore. We encourage you to visit our website at aim.org and sign up to receive our daily email so you can keep track of what the media are up to. I am Roger Aronoff, a media analyst with AIM, and we have a great show today. We have Tim Phillips of Americans for Prosperity. We have Dana Lesh and Brian Anderson, who we will introduce later, and my co-host, Don Irvine, Accuracy in Media's chairman, is with us. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Roger.
Why don't you take it from here?
You're breaking up there.
Oh, okay. Let's see here. Okay. Don, go ahead.
You can hear me?
Are you there, Tim?
Yes, I'm here. Good morning.
Okay. Good morning, Tim. This is Don Irvine.
Hey, Don.
Well, what I want to do this morning was spend a few minutes with you to talk about Americans for Prosperity Foundation and some of your activities. First, can you tell us a little bit about the Americans for Prosperity Foundation and AFP?
Absolutely, Don. Thanks for having us on. Americans for Prosperity is a grassroots organization that focuses on free market issues. The biggest two we're focusing on at the federal level this year are this healthcare takeover attempt and the cap and trade or cap and tax legislation on the energy front. And our goal is to get as many activists across the country as possible out working and fighting for freedom. So we do rallies and events, and we have a national summit coming up in a week here. We go in the states and do bus tours, and then with our activist list that's now over 800,000 folks, we urge them to email and call their legislators during key times.
Well, you just mentioned the upcoming summit. This will be your third annual Defending the American Dream Summit, if I have that correct. Tell me more about this.
Yes, sir, it is. It's our third one. Our initial thought was, let's bring some of our most active grassroots people in from around the country. Let's spend a couple of days together and really focus on accomplishing three key goals. Number one, late in the year, bring their passion and their energy to Washington in a way that just keeps the pressure up. So on October the 2nd, the first day of the summit, we'll do a national town hall meeting at the Capitol at 2 p.m., from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern time, and we'll keep the pressure up on the healthcare issue. We're going to have a couple of the senators there joining us. We'll have a lot of our activists just talking about their concerns and fears over this healthcare takeover, and we just want to make sure that as they go down the stretch run in this healthcare battle, they know that people back home are still watching. So that's the first goal. The second goal is to educate and train our activists to make them even more effective. So we do a lot of breakout sessions and a lot of training with a lot of the Tea Party organizers around the country. We'll have some of the best Tea Party activists, Terry Adams, who runs the Philadelphia Tea Parties, Jim Bratton from Evansville, Indiana, other great Tea Party folks, our own AFP activists as well. It's a good mix. So to train and educate. And then the third thing, frankly, Don, is to continue to inspire and motivate. You know, it's a long battle. Our folks, the last thing they want to do is to be involved with government, right? They want to, you know, earn a living, live their lives, be active in their communities or churches or synagogues. This is a sacrifice, this activism. And so we just want to tell them thank you and make sure that they hopefully stay motivated and inspired during this crucial time. So we have speakers like Laura Ingraham, who's one of my favorite radio hosts across the country and a Fox News anchor often, and other, you know, Steve Moore from the Wall Street Journal, and Herman Cain, who's one of the great motivators on the free market conservative side, radio host out of Georgia, and just Senator Jim DeMint, who's a great champion, Congressman Mike Pence from Indiana, you know, folks like that.
I was at the conference last year, and I was impressed at the size of the crowd and how that was going. How do you attract these, you know, these national speakers, and how was the crowd, you know, attendance last year? What are you expecting this year?
We had just over 1,600 of our really most active grassroots folks came in from 37 states last year, Don. I think this year will probably be around 2,000. It's kind of like a national convention for free market activism. That's the best way I know to put it. I mean, it's not meant, you know, to be a mass rally or march. We were proud to be a part of 912 working and along with so many other Tea Party groups and other organizations out there. We do rallies and other mass events around the country, but this is intended almost like a national convention. We have a roll call of the states, so we have our AFP chapters from the 25 states where we have chapters. They get up and give reports, and I think that really the energy attracts people, and I think we'll probably have 2,000 or so folks. It'll be bigger than last year, and the other thing that's exciting about this, Don, I know that it helps me to know that I'm part of something bigger than just myself, or maybe just my county. I live in Loudoun County out in Virginia, or maybe bigger than just my state of Virginia or Commonwealth of Virginia. It's exciting to know I'm part of a genuine national movement, you know, that's grassroots. It's not being directed from the top down, because that's not, as you know, Don, that's not how our movement works. We're individualistic, and folks kind of, you know, do as they think best. But it's great for them to be able to come together at a kind of a convention like this, if you will, to know, hey, I'm a part of something that's a lot bigger than me. It's bigger than my state. This is a national movement for freedom at a crucial time for our country.
Do you see this, you know, it's coming just a few weeks after that 9/12 march. Do you see this as a great opportunity for your organization to kind of keep this momentum going and maybe set the direction and the tone here in the coming months?
Well, our concern, the biggest concern I have right now, just as a grassroots activist, Don, is that the other side, Obama and Pelosi and Reid, are going to stretch this health care and this cap-and-trade battle out. They're going to stall it out. They're already saying they're going to go into late October, maybe November. I mean, there's even been talk of December. And I believe, Don, that they're hoping that our side will lose our fire, grow weary, go back to other activities and priorities, and they'll be able to eventually wear us down. And one thing I like about this Defending the American Dream Summit on October 2nd and 3rd, coming about 3 weeks after the really large 9/12 march, coming about a month and a half after all the town hall events around the country and all the bus rallies and everything else that we were doing and other groups were doing, it's just another steady drip, drip, drip that, hey, we're not going away. We're taking time out of our lives and schedule to come to Washington again, and we're not going away. And I think that's an important element to this Defending the American Dream Summit. But we've been doing it now for several years, as you said, for 3 years. So this will be our third one. So it's always kind of been a goal to keep doing this, just to keep our core activists together and motivated and educated and to, you know, to make sure we keep sending a message to Washington. But maybe this year it takes on a little bit of added significance.
One thing I noticed in attending last year's summit was how friendly the organization was to bloggers and new media. Do you see this as being an important segment of some, you know, population, a group that you want to continue to work with?
Very much, Don. I am technologically challenged myself, but about 2.5 years ago, or 2 years ago, I guess, I met a fellow named Eric Telford, a young man who came to AFP, Americans for Prosperity, and became our director of new media outreach and membership, new outreach. And he has done an amazing job of helping make our organization and really the broad conservative movement more new media savvy. And from early on, he would preach to us and to me, you know, hey, look, bloggers are such a key part of our coalition. They're the unsung heroes in many ways because they often very quietly, day in and day out, are banging away, providing information, providing inspiration, passing along key notes, bringing up key mistakes by the other side, praising some of the good guys on our side. And at AFP, we ought to reach out to them. And under Eric's leadership and a lot of our state directors around the country, we've done that. And so we have a bloggers row that is focused on making sure that they have the tools they need and everything else to be able to report back to their readers what's going on at this summit. That'll be the case again. We'll have well over 100 bloggers in on Bloggers Row this year. One other thing, we do the Write Online conferences that, Don, that you're familiar with. We were up in Pittsburgh. We go wherever Netroots Nation is. So a couple years ago, Eric said, you know what, let's take on Netroots Nation, a liberal big new media operation. So 2 years ago, it was Austin, Texas. You know, we took our first Write Online conference there. We trained over 500 bloggers and activists and how to be more effective on new media. This year it was Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, same thing. We had over 660 this year. And next year it's Las Vegas, Nevada, and we're going to keep doing that. Those Write Online conferences, we'll have a Write Online training segment, excuse me, at our national summit as well.
Now, you were mentioning how you're going to have this Capitol Hill visit as part of the Defending American Dream Summit. Is this going to be an outdoor event? Basically, you've got a place that you're going to do this? Because, I mean, I assume you're going to have a fairly large crowd that will be up there.
Yep, we'll have a pretty large crowd. We're going to be at the Senate Park, which is kind of the grassy area with the fountain over next to the Senate offices. And we'll have signs up that day showing where to go. We're hoping for good weather. We do have tent capabilities, but we have to do the very lightweight kind in order to pass Capitol Hill regulations and such. But it is outdoors at the Senate Park there at 2 o'clock. And the goal with that, Don, is to focus on the hands-off my healthcare. You know, we've got two buses that have traveled the country. We've done over 500 rallies, hands-off for my healthcare rallies, just across the country. I was in Bozeman, Montana, all the way to the eastern shore of Maryland, to Ocean City, Maryland at one point. And we're bringing our buses in, and we're going to make it a hands-off my healthcare town hall meeting. So it'll be outdoors in the park there on the Senate side where the fountain is. It's a very nice setting, and I think we'll be able to get a lot of media coverage there because we're not new to this healthcare battle. We've been doing events around the country, and I think the media is intrigued by, okay, what do they have to say at this point, you know, this late in the debate? And sadly, watching what's going on in Baucus's Senate Finance Committee, where they, you know, they killed the transparency, the ability of folks to really look at what's going on with this healthcare legislation. We're going to have lots of shenanigans to report, unfortunately, Don, as I know your organization is as well.
You know, we're talking about cap and trade and healthcare, obviously big issues. Lately, we've had this, you know, this Acorn big story come out here. Do you expect that will be somewhat of a sub theme flying through the conference, maybe?
I think it's going to absolutely get a lot of attention. I saw where the IRS is revoking the partnership or the informal partnership they've had with Acorn, which, I mean, is way past due. I know a lot of good conservative lawmakers are now calling for investigations into Acorn. Gosh, Don, I mean, the videos were bad enough, but it seems like there's been such a cloud around that organization for a long time because they seem to cross the line about every day or every week, and I think it will be. I mean, I think it's something that when an organization has as many brushes with, I don't know if the law is the right word, but as many brushes with the legal lines and the compliance lines that they seem to have every year, every month, I think it absolutely ought to be looked at, and I think the folks will be doing that at our conference as well.
Now, I also notice on the schedule that you've got a film screening for Not Evil, Just Wrong. Is that going to be before?
We're excited about that. Ann McElhaney, I know you know her, Don. They have I've seen the film. It's such an important message, and we wanted to make sure as many of our activists as possible saw it. So we first screened it up at our Write Online conference in Pittsburgh back in August, and people loved it. The information that was so powerful, but not just the information, the way it was entertaining and so fast-moving, it kept you engrossed in the action while delivering a very powerful, important message. So we invited Ann and her husband to come back, and so Friday night after our Tribute to Reagan dinner with Laura Ingraham and Congressman Mike Pence as our keynote speakers, and some really great vintage Reagan footage and videos that we always love to show. The Reagan Library gave us permission. We love to show the footage of the greatest president, at least certainly my favorite president. And we'll do a viewing of that film afterwards on Friday night, and then Ann and her husband will stick around on Saturday as well to sign copies of the DVD. And then I know on October 18, they've got a big premiere around the country. They're hoping to have as many grassroots viewings of the film as possible. And I know at Americans for Prosperity, they're a good sister operation, and we're going to try to help as much with that as possible.
I noticed also another thing on the agenda, too, that just also something very, very timely is there's going to be a special session on net neutrality. We just saw some things come out this week by the FCC about that. What do you expect to happen there?
Well, we've long had an interest in that issue because it's a freedom issue. It's a government encroachment issue in our view. And I think that the FCC hearings were, I think it was enlightening. And I know we're going to keep this issue on the burner because in the end, the government, we need to get the government to stop intruding into so many aspects of commerce and business on just a daily basis. I mean, I think about net neutrality. I think about the cash for clunkers. I think about the new Wall Street regulations they're getting ready to try to jam through here in the next few weeks in the Congress. And we've got a government right now, an administration right now, who feels like they have a carte blanche to go into every area of commerce, Don, and start overreaching and regulating. And we've got to continue to push back. And sometimes it's hard to push back on regulations like that because they're hard to understand sometimes. They're hard to get your arms around. And we're going to keep doing that. The one thing that drove me nuts about the last few months is we're so busy fighting the healthcare and cap and trade battles, which again I think are the two most important battles, but very often we miss, just because of the sheer onslaught facing us as a movement, we miss some of the quieter regulations, you know, that are pushing through. And I mean, look at EPA and Environmental Protection Agency and where they're going with regulating CO2 emissions. It's kind of a backdoor approach, you know, the regulatory approach to cap and trade. So we're going to keep pushing back across the board on as many of these regs and overreaches as we can.
Well, you know, I need to let you go here and everything, but how can people find out more about the summit, register, et cetera?
Absolutely. And Don, thanks for having us on. And the two easiest ways would be either to email go to our website, AmericansForProsperity.org, AmericansForProsperity.org. We have the registration site there. And also, we've got plenty of information on the summit and all the different events. The agenda that I just discussed and that you and I discussed with speakers and such is right there. Or they can call our office here in D.C., which is 202-349-5880, 202-349-5880. Or they can Facebook me. I'm on Facebook. I do it myself. I enjoy being on that. I guess I'm new to it, so I'm a newbie, but Tim Phillips, obviously, at Facebook, Americans for Prosperity, and they can make contact with me, and I always respond pretty quickly as well.
Well, Tim, I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. I look forward to seeing you over at the summit when I get over there, and we'll talk again.
Don, thanks for having me on. Thanks for all you guys do.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Bye.
Let's see. Hi, Dana, are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you?
Okay, very well, thank you. This is Roger Aronoff, and I'm on with my co-host Don Irvine of Accuracy in Media.
Yeah.
And we're thrilled to have you on. I want to give a little of your interesting background, and we think you represent a sort of prototypical new media person. And so Dana Lesh began blogging back in 2001. She blogged at danaradio.com and mamalogs.com and hosts her own radio show, The Dana Show, on KFTK in St. Louis, and was named by the Riverfront Times as the best columnist of 2007 and selected as one of St. Louis's 30 Under 30 by the St. Louis Business Journal in 2008. And she appears regularly on Fox News and CNN and writes for BigGovernment.com and vlogs, another new media element, for Momversation, She speaks regularly on the subject of activism and Netroots. And one more thing, Dana, when I was researching for this segment, I came across something that said you're on a list as the number one of the 15 hottest conservative women in the new media.
That's true. they were very conservative to me, right-wing news.
That was a list that also included Ann Coulter and Michelle Malkin, who were well back behind you in that list. So congratulations.
Oh. Thank you.
Well, you are sort of a self-made new media person. Tell us about your path from relative obscurity, if I may, to becoming a force to be reckoned with from the show-me state.
Oh, well, goodness. I studied print journalism in school, which, you know, obviously we all know how well that industry is doing now. And I was really aggravated because I felt like I was constantly being censored by my editors. I wrote for quite a liberal publication in St. Louis. And so I decided to start blogging. And when Bush was against Kerry, I blogged about conservative politics, and I had to do so anonymously, because I didn't know really any other conservative bloggers aside from Drudge that were online at the time. And then Glenn Reynolds came online, Jim Hoffa, Gateway Pundit, and a lot of other people were brave enough to use their names at first. I did not. I took a sabbatical from it when I had my first child, and then a couple of years ago, decided to jump back into it because I was raised with politics. My family, though, are Democrats, and they're very active politically, and I've been raised with it, and so I just started writing. I had a column with the local paper here, and it kind of went from there. I had guests on Jamie Allman's radio show in the morning, and then the next thing that I knew, I was in the office of the vice president for MS Communications. Won a radio show. We will put you on air right now, and I thought they were crazy, but it went from there. So it just I don't know. I've always been sort of a nerd, technologically speaking, and I right when I first started writing online, I had like this very basic, nasty-looking PHP platform that I used, and I included pop culture and politics, and we had a lot of people that were writing for it and people that were commenting and interacting, and I knew that at some point media was going to take this very interactive, very citizen-led path. Because we already saw that traditional media, we already saw that circulation was down for a lot of the newspapers, advertising rates were falling, and it's something that I love to do, and I just wanted to stick with it, and then everything kind of went from there.
Dana, this is Donna Irvine. You were mentioning your radio show and how you kind of fell into that.
I feel like it's an insult to people who've been doing it for a long time. I'm always like very cautious when I talk about it because there's people who've been broadcasting forever, and they're so good at what they do. And then I'm like, I just fell into my radio show.
Well, how's the show going?
It's going fantastic. We're going daily, starting this Monday, actually, on the 28th. So it's number one in its market on Sunday night, and it's going daily on Monday. So I'm really excited about that, 7 p.m. Central.
Well, we saw you last week on Fox on the Cavuto show talking about a story you had blogged about. It involved a White House website called serve.gov.
Yeah.
Tell us what you found out there.
Well, basically, we heard a lot about serve.gov. We heard a lot about the president wanting to put together some kind of online clearinghouse for volunteers and for activism, which sounds really, really good, but you can't have a politician do something like that and keep the partisan agenda out of it. There's just, it hasn't been done, or I don't ever foresee it being done. But with serve.gov, after everything that happened with Acorn, I was kind of curious to see what sort of things would pop up if you searched for them on that volunteer site. And you type in Acorn in the search field that says, what interests you? And I was shocked at all of the volunteer opportunities that popped up that had to do with Acorn. I mean, it was so blatant, it was kind of amusing. There was a volunteer opportunity for a healthcare activist. There was another volunteer opportunity for a tax preparer at the Acorn office in New Orleans. There was another volunteer opportunity in Ohio at the Acorn offices for their Get Out the Vote initiative. And considering our for voter registration fraud, I thought that was kind of funny that was still listed on serve.gov. And some of the volunteer opportunities, when you would type it in, it would transport you to the site called allforgood.org. But the three opportunities that I missed, that I mentioned, and we got screenshots of all of them, and they're listed up at biggovernment.com, were actually on the serve.gov site, especially the most contentious of them, the Get Out the Vote one and then the Healthcare Act. I mean, these were actually listed on the serve.gov site. So basically what we had was a taxpayer-supported federal website that was using its resources to funnel activists to volunteer opportunities so as to promote the president's agenda. And we saw that happen, and we see how the NEA has essentially been co-opted by the administration to push its initiatives. And it's just it just seems to be the blatant corruption, I guess, with it, and that they didn't care. I mean, they were out there for that long. It just sort of shocked me, I guess.
Yes, and with all the attention on ACORN these past couple weeks, this was certainly bad timing for both ACORN and the White House, and it just seems that, you know, with Obama's past history with ACORN, as someone who represented them in legal matters and had been involved mm-hmm. in training, and then he made this comment the other on one of his, I think, 22 talk show appearances last Sunday, where he said that he had no idea that they were receiving so much government money. Now, that was
oh,
bit...
I don't buy that.
yeah,
that's yeah.
So did this get any coverage? This serve.gov? Did you see anything in the mainstream media about it, or was it?
No, I did not see anything. The only people who gave it coverage were Fox News. And then bloggers and web radio hosts, they were all over it. And I wasn't surprised that the mainstream media wouldn't report it. I didn't count on it, though, and I didn't want to measure, I guess, the reach that this story had by the reactions of mainstream media, because I don't think we can anymore. I think it's absolutely dead, which is really sad. And I think people like Andrew Breitbart, and James O'Keefe and Hannah Giles and all of these and Jim Hoff, all these people that are going out doing news, they really make me have hope for the future of journalism, like real actual journalism. So the way that the blogosphere responded to it, the way that web radio hosts responded to it, that Fox responded to it, I knew that the reach of it was really huge, and I knew that the mainstream media wasn't going to report it.
So I saw a blog posting you did last night about the cap and trade bill regarding homeowners. Tell us what you found out.
Well, a rewrite of the cap and trade, or an addendum to it, rather, would essentially put so many regulations if you're going to sell your home. And we have a 117-year-old home, and a lot of the homes in St. Louis are really old or historic. And if this legislation were to pass as it's written, what would happen is that if we were to try to sell our home, then the government would come in. We would have to pay for the government to come in, and they would look at everything from our light bulbs to our windows. And if our windows weren't certain energy efficiency, we couldn't sell the home unless we replaced it. If they didn't like the energy efficiency of our appliances, we couldn't sell the home until we replaced all of those appliances. I mean, it's just absolute micromanagement, and it infuriates me because this is a government, this is an administration that prides itself on being so open, to being so, of service to lower-income families. And then we had Cash for Clunkers, which did just the opposite for lower-income families. They weren't able to buy used cars anymore. This piece of legislation does the same thing. It does absolutely nothing to foster an increase in homeownership. It does the absolute opposite. In fact, what we will see is a higher rate of foreclosure. We'll see more and more people just simply walking away from their homes. We'll see more and more people renting, and we'll see lower-income families unable to get a home because they're not going to be able to pay for these massive government regulations that are going to be affecting buyers and sellers. And we'll see people, even lower-income families that do own a home, perhaps they want to upgrade, or perhaps they want to do something to improve their home. They're not going to be able to afford to do it, and people used to take such pride in fixing up their homes. Like the whole, I know Hot Air had a piece that says the whole, the history of the fixer-upper, the whole legacy of the fixer-upper home in America would essentially be destroyed with this piece of legislation, and that's absolutely true. It's government bureaucracy run rampant. I was so shocked that anyone would actually put this into a bill, and I believe Barbara Boxer is the co-author or co-sponsor, and it just, I'm just, it, it just shocks me. Here we have people losing their homes right and left, and the president is constantly talking about what he's going to do to help us, to help this foreclosure rate, to help more and more people get into homes. This is going to do the exact opposite of it. And it's a continual pattern with this administration. They say one thing, and they do the absolute opposite of what they're intending to do. And they usually have to backpedal and apologize for things and rewrite things on their websites and scrub things on their websites. It's just one mistake after the other.
Well, we've had mentioned here a couple times of Andrew Breitbart's website, Big Government, and obviously they've become extremely famous now, or infamous, for posting the Acorn video showing how willingly the associates there were willing to discuss ways for people they never even met to break the law.
Yeah.
As I understand it now, Acorn is filing suit against Breitbart and others. What is your opinion, your take on that?
Oh, I think that's going to get thrown out. There's no way. In Maryland, they have a two-way consent law. Like in states like Missouri, if I wanted to record our conversation, I wouldn't have to let you know about it. I would just do it, and that's it. In Maryland, the law as it's written states that they would have to notify the other party. They would have to have the two-way consent for recording that. Which begs the question: like, do the pedophiles, do they sue Dateline NBC after Dateline NBC says that these things and catches these people? I think it's just a distraction. Their lawsuit is just a distraction, because if this does go to court, and if they try to take it all the way to the courthouse, then they are opening themselves up for such investigation that everything that they have done, will do, are doing is going to be scrutinized. And I think they're just bluffing. They're just saber-rattling right now. I really don't think that anything is going to come of that suit, just because they don't want to compromise themselves any more than they will have to if this does go full on to court. So I think it's great what Breitbart and them did. And I can't believe that these people, they would think that two-way consent, that's the fact that, we weren't notified, that's horrible. But talking to a pimp and a prostitute about how to traffic in child sex slaves, that's apparently okay. I guess their law, their civil rights, they view those greater than the children that they were going to be trafficking in. It's just, it's comical. It'd be comical if it wasn't so sad, really.
And I think you're right. It was always my understanding on the two-way consent, and I could obviously be wrong, was that that was really meant for audio recording. Video recording really wasn't part of the initial law or coverage, I think, at the time. So I think that's still a little bit murky on that end.
Yeah.
And I do think that, the very idea that they do sue, it does open themselves up to more questions that I don't know who is advising them, but it's probably not the best thing in the world for them to do.
It's probably one of the volunteers that they had go through serve.gov. They probably advertised for legal advice.
Well, Breitbart also broke another big alternative media story this week about the NEA, the National
mm-hmm.
Endowment for the Arts. Can you tell me what that story was all about?
Oh, this is something close to my heart, because we actually work in the arts industry. My husband does, and it's just basically what we had is we had Yoshi Sargent, who is the communications director for the National Endowment of the Arts. We had Mel Abernathy with United We Serve. We had Buffy Wicks with the White House of the Office of Engagement on this conference call, spearheading this conference call, and they were joined by singers and songwriters, musicians, artists, artist development, music management, all kinds of people who are involved with sort of shaping the artistic trajectory of society. They had all these people on this call, and Sargent maintained that, and for so long denied that the NEA was doing anything other than trying to encourage artists to get involved with just issues and things of that nature. But as we saw, or as we heard with the audio and we read with the transcript, he and Buffy Wicks with the White House were actually encouraging artists to do what they can to spread the message about the president's health care legislation. They're trying to co-opt our artistic community, which is very Leni Riefenstahl-esque to me. And I use that, I think that's such a apropos analogy too. The majority of artists are supported by the NEA, and it makes me afraid for our artistic community, because these people, they're dependent upon these grants and things that they get from this organization that is being run by an administration apparently that's saying, well, we want you to do this for us. And as we read with the transcript and we heard with the audio that's still up at biggovernment.com, it was absolutely shocking. I mean, Buffy was saying, we are running the government now, and Sarjan is explaining ways to these artists, like, oh, this is what you could do to help spread awareness about the president's health care legislation. This is a taxpayer-funded organization that is violating its charter. I don't even know if what tax laws it's violating right now by politicizing itself in such a manner. And it is this administration that is just doing everything that it can to counter the dying support for its initiatives, because every single poll that is coming out, I think the latest Rasmussen poll this week, shows that the overwhelming majority of Americans do not support his health care legislation. And the support for cap and trade is starting to match that. And they're trying to reach out and do whatever they can to drum up some kind of synthetic support for their initiative. And co-opting the artistic community just seems absolutely the lowest of the low to me, because they claim to support this community. And this community, the fact that so many of them were just so willing to go into it, they're the ones who always cry about being called sellouts. Well, this is the ultimate in selling out, selling your soul for a partisan political agenda. Sad.
Well, except for a story about it in the Politico and I think on Jake Tapper's blog on ABC.com, I don't recall really seeing anything else about this, you know, in, say, the mainstream press. Do you think that will happen?
I don't think so. I really don't. I think this is going to be another case of the conservative blogosphere and just really driving the story. And I don't even think we need the media anymore. I don't think we need, and I know Glenn Beck calls them the fringe media, which, you know, I know there's a lot of blogs out there that have higher IP visits daily than some publications have circulation. It's been the conservative blogosphere that really toppled Van Jones, that helped kind of push Van Jones over the edge. It's been the conservative blogosphere that's done this ACORN, that's done NEA, it's in the past that has taken, like Dan Rather. I think that the media has proven itself irrelevant. So if they choose not to report on it, that's totally fine. They're going to at some point. Whether they're reporting on it as the right wing or attacking the NEA, however they're going to do it, but they're going to be forced to report on it at some point. But for the most part, I think they'll ignore it, and that's fine. They can ignore it at their own risk.
Dana, we need to wrap it up. So I'll just give a word of advice to other people who may be aspiring to do the same thing you've done, sort of become a blogger, a vlogger, a new media person all the way around, and then we need to wrap it up here. So
go ahead. Well, I guess have a passion for what you do. Have a dedication to truth. No politician, no party is sacred. The only thing that is sacred is liberty. And check your facts. Always double-check your facts, because a blogger's reputation, that's what makes or breaks a blogger. It's your reputation. So make sure that whatever you put up, Google never forgets.
That's a great point. Okay, well, listen, keep it up, and thank you so much for being on Take Aim with us today, and we wish you all the best. You bet, and we'll be back in touch. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Our next guest is Brian Anderson. Are you there, Brian?
Yes, sir, I am.
Hi, welcome to Take Aim. This is Roger Aronoff and Don Irvine.
Thanks, gentlemen, for having me on.
So let me... Tell our guests, our audience a little about you. You are the editor of City Journal, the cultural and political quarterly published by the Manhattan Institute. Your work has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, LA Times, Commentary, National Review, Weekly Standard, and many others. And you are the author of several very well-received books, including South Park Conservatives, and last year's A Manifesto for Media Freedom. The New York Times described Brian Anderson as one of the most probing and erudite political essayists of our day. But we won't hold that against him. Welcome to Take Aim. Brian, tell us a little more about yourself and how you came to be the Manhattan Institute came to the Manhattan Institute writing about topics like net neutrality and the Fairness Doctrine, which we'll get into more in a little bit.
Sure. I've actually been at City Journal now for 11 years and editor-in-chief for the last 3 years. For these media issues, I really got interested in them with an earlier book I wrote called South Park Conservatives, which title notwithstanding was really about the new media revolution that was transforming political debate in the country. And so in that book, I chronicled the rise of talk radio, the emergence of cable news in the mid-90s, and then as the new millennium turned, the real arrival of the Internet as a news and information source with the blogosphere and all the various websites that emerged in that period. And the argument of that book was that this this profusion of outlets and commentary and analysis was really allowing into public debate a lot of right-of-center views as well as farther-left views in a way that was shaking up the kind of complacent liberal-dominated media of the pre-new media era. And so this subsequent book, a Manifesto for Media Freedom, that I co-wrote with Andrew Thierer last year, was looking at the effort to re-regulate a lot of this stuff and kind of get the genie back in the bottle. And there's a lot of folks, in my view, in the liberal camp who would really like a much more restrained media universe similar to what you find in Europe or Canada. And so, you know, in that book we discuss the campaign to kind of re-regulate talk radio through Fairness Doctrine and localism mandates and the troubling possibility that you would see a greater regulation of even the Internet through things like network neutrality. And, this we see is happening.
Let's get into that, because this week President Obama's choice to be chairman of the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, Julius Genachowski, announced plans to support or impose net neutrality. And who can be opposed to neutrality? But tell us what this really means and what are the implications of this change in policy.
Well, Genachowski said that the FCC would now be the smart cop on the beat when it came to Internet traffic. And I think everybody, when you look closely at this issue, would be a little troubled by that kind of comment. Now, network neutrality is the idea that every single bit of information that's on that's flowing across the Internet's pipes, the broadband provided pipes, has to be treated equally, so that the people who are providing web services aren't allowed to offer faster service to sites or users who might be willing to pay extra, in the way FedEx will speed up packages for a fee, or to manage their services in various other active ways, and they want to do this. And a lot of people on the left say, well, no, this is going to transform the Internet as we know it. Now, my view is that network neutrality is economically very misguided, because the broadband providers, why should they continue to keep making the networks necessary for 21st century traffic if they're not going to be able to recoup some of the considerable investments by providing new services to people via the Internet? Net neutrality would make, against the law, stuff that just makes sense from the standpoint of traffic management. This gets pretty arcane, but Internet providers would like to slow down in certain circumstances the service of some guy who's out there downloading, 10 big movies for free, so that the emailer who's sending his emails can get his email through quickly. When everything is nominally free, there's no incentive for the guy downloading a million things to to make way for the casual emailer. So the internet providers will manage this traffic. They will sometimes try to slow down the heavy bandwidth user so a casual user can get his services through more quickly.
But do you see a more sinister motive, maybe controlling content? And
The proponents of net neutrality say that this is what's scary and why we need net neutrality. They say that the broadband providers will create these walled-off gardens, and they'll block sites that they don't like, or they'll restrict content. Now, I think there is almost no evidence that this has happened. There's been a couple of instances. It gets the incentives wrong. The web providers want to provide content. That's their competitive edge. And so if it gets out that they're blocking content, they're going to get hammered for that. They want more and more content on their pipes. So I think it's a pretty flimsy argument on that side. I think the more troubling implication is if you have, and that's something that this measure will do, increased FCC control over the Internet. Because if you have greater government regulation of the Internet, it's not inconceivable, in my view, that you could start seeing fairness mandates extended to online opinion sites. The FCC Commissioner Robert McDowell warned last year that this is anything but far-fetched. This is a real concern. So you would have a kind of fairness doctrine for the Internet. And the European Union has looked at applying fairness requirements to opinion websites in Europe. And the guy that the Obama administration has appointed to be their kind of regulatory czar, a very brilliant law professor, Cass Sunstein, he has in the past argued for this, that websites, opinion websites online, should have electronic sidewalks that would accompany every partisan view, giving the other side. So this would be, in effect, a kind of fairness doctrine for the web. Now, Sunstein has backed away from that and says he no longer supports it, and it would be very difficult to apply. There would be feasibility questions here. But the impulse and the prospect are both troubling. The idea that the FCC will now be the smart cop on the beat, as Commissioner Jenikowski put it, I think is very troubling.
Well, that's a good segue into talking about the fairness doctrine. You've written quite extensively about this doctrine. Can you give us a quick history lesson on what it was and why it was ended?
Yeah, Adam Thier and I, in this book, A Manifesto for Media Freedom, we have a chapter which recounts the history of the fairness doctrine. And for those who don't remember it, it was an FCC mandate that required broadcasters on radio and later on television to offer basically not an equal balance but a fair balance of alternative viewpoints, subject to potential fines, subject to, at the limit, a loss of license if they didn't get the right mix on the air. You know, what it did was basically put government regulators in the role of speech monitors. And as we point out in the book, the history of this wasn't really that pretty, because both parties, Republicans and Democrats, used the threat of fairness doctrine sanctions to go after their political enemies on the airwaves. And really what it amounted to creating was a kind of muzzling effect on opinion on the airwaves. Talk radio in today's sense really didn't exist prior to the late 80s, early 90s. It was really the early 90s when the Reagan administration started backing away from the fairness doctrine and eventually got rid of it entirely. That created the freedom or unleashed the freedom for radio stations to offer opinion broadcasting without worrying about government regulators and losing their license. And so then you just had this, massive surge of opinion on the airwaves. And, I mentioned Europe earlier, or Canada. There's nothing really comparable to American talk radio and other democracies. It's a very vigorous, freewheeling format. And in my view, it's been a very positive development. But a lot of people are troubled by it because it is so opinionated.
Well, So now we have that history lesson. Let's bring us up to date here. What's currently going on with the Fairness Doctrine? We had some Democrats in Congress previously trying to get some legislation going to reimpose the Fairness Doctrine, though there are a lot of people out there that say, you know, we're really actually against it. You know, where are we today?
Well, you know, the over the last several years, there was, you know, if you started paying attention to what leading Democrats were saying, Nancy Pelosi, John Kerry, Al Gore, all of them were starting to say, you know what, we need to start thinking about bringing back the old Fairness Doctrine, reimposing it. The idea is that this would just shut up all those conservatives on talk radio. It's really a missile aimed at conservative talk radio, I think we say in the book. And here's why. If a station ran, I don't know, you know, a popular radio show, Bill Bennett or Hugh Hewitt or something, they'd have to broadcast a liberal alternative to keep that show on the air. But while conservatives do very well on talk radio, liberals just can't get an audience. They've tanked on the radio over and over and over again, and there's a variety of reasons for this. One of which is the fact that they're so well represented, in other media outlets, including in daily newspapers. But you know, the stations, they would not run the liberal show and the conservative show. What they would probably do is change formats. And when I've talked to radio broadcasters about this, they say, yeah, you know, we just get out of it. We go to entertainment reporting or food or sports talk or talk about cars, anything, you know, anything to get us away from politics. And I think that's the real desire on the part of many Democrats. They would just like to shut down the medium because they do have a much greater preponderance of voices in other media outlets. But I think, I think the constitutionality of this would be problematic in the 21st century. And I think the Democrats have started to back away from a direct imposition of the Fairness Doctrine. I don't know if they'd get the votes for it. And even if they could, I think the Supreme Court might overturn any reimposition. But they're shifting tactics now. They're promoting something called localism, which they view as a different way of getting at the same outcome, which would be fewer conservative voices on the air.
So speaking of localism, this came out of most prominently out of a report from the left-wing Center for American Progress, and one of the authors of that report, Mark Lloyd, was recently named to be the chief diversity officer at the FCC.
Yeah.
And so it seems go ahead.
It's very troubling as well. And, again, in talking to various radio executives, this is now what they're most concerned about. And maybe for your listeners, it would be useful just to define what localism amounts to. It would require stations to carry a certain percentage of local content, whether via hosts or local coverage, in order to get their licenses reaffirmed. It would also, you know, imply breaking up some of the big syndicators and allocating those stations to local minority groups in various areas of the country. You mentioned the study from John Podesta's group a moment ago. This was really the springboard for this push to localism. You're absolutely right about that. And the idea is that it would, again, diversify the airwaves by getting the conservatives off the air, basically, and replacing them with local programming. The assumption being that a lot of the local programming might be politically more to the left. The arrogance of this is quite astonishing, because it's of course only possible for conservatives to be on the airwaves because people want to listen to them. So what we're saying with the FCC is, people's choices aren't acceptable here. Therefore, we have to remake the system so that, you know, they're forced to listen to basically something they may not want to listen to. Maybe they don't want local content. Maybe they want to get out of their local environment and listen to something that focuses on the national level. I'm not of the opinion that the FCC should be making these decisions at this stage.
Okay, so how do you see this playing out? You know, will the effort be made in Congress or at the FCC?
It'll be at the FCC. I don't think you would need congressional legislation on this. The FCC could just say, and they've already got a ruling out there saying they're, you know, thinking about moving strong in this direction. They could just change the rules, and therefore you would have some litigation. Some of the stations would fight back, and I don't know exactly how that would play out. I don't think anybody does. But they could certainly pressure radio stations to start. You know, one of the proposals the FCC has is to establish boards for radio stations made up of various groups in the community that aren't adequately represented. But what does this mean in practice? Does it mean that a Christian radio broadcaster that happens to be broadcasting in an area with a heavy Muslim population, would it have to have Muslims on its board weighing in on the content of what that Christian station is broadcasting? Nobody knows. But broadcasters are very, very worried about this.
Well, you mentioned earlier about, you know, if the Fairness Doctrine comes back in, that the stations are more likely to change their formats. You know, what happens to the stations if they start trying to take off Rush, Sean Hannity, you know, et cetera? You know, what does it do to their profitability, their ability to sustain themselves?
Well, you're absolutely right. This is it's a very competitive media marketplace now. You take off some of your more popular programming and replace it with stuff that may not have name recognition, may not have any interest for listeners. You're going to push a lot of these stations over the edge. Their profit margins are very, very tight right now. What you'd wind up doing is empowering the Internet further, I think, because a lot of these broadcasters would launch ventures on the Internet, or they go to satellite radio, which currently isn't regulated by the Fairness Doctrine or localism mandates. But it would still shake up the one media area where right-of-center voices, whether libertarian or conservatives, have a preponderant voice. And that's why there's so much attention coming from the left directing fire at this media outlet.
Brian, we're going to have to wrap it up here in a minute, but let me ask you this. You brought up your book. We talked about a manifesto for media freedom. Tell us, what is your blueprint to preserve a free press in this country? I know many conservatives are very worried that this is really, that everything's lined up now for this control of the Internet and control of TV and radio is about to happen. Do you think it is, and what can be done to prevent it at this point?
Well, I think you need a public education campaign, and I think conservative members of Congress need to be talking about this. I think they need to recognize that the entire country, including the Republican Party and conservatives and libertarians, have benefited from a more open media. You know, everybody will see something in the media or hear something or read something that they don't like, that they find offensive, and there's a lot of stuff out there I don't like. But on balance, the proliferation of voices has increased the conservative presence. It's become a counterweight to the liberal media, the liberal old line media. So I think that a lot of conservatives have to embrace a more vigorous free speech model for approaching media issues. There's guys in Congress like Mike Pence who are very knowledgeable on this issue. He's been speaking regularly about it. I just think it's a matter of the public being made aware that there are implications here when the government is pursuing something called fairness or neutrality. These are benign sounding words, but the implications are going to be quite significant for how people get their information, how they educate themselves.
Brian, tell our listeners real quickly how they can visit your website and read your articles and get your books and just give
sure,
it
sure. Absolutely. Well, thanks again for having me on. I'm editor, as we had mentioned, of a magazine called City Journal. published by Manhattan Institute in New York, but it's a national magazine. The website is www.city-journal.org, and my stuff's on there, and my many great writers, Heather McDonald, Victor Davis Hanson, many others, you can find their work there, and all of the books we've written are also available on the website, including this media book.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, and we want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in today to Take Aim, and we will be back next week. So for this week, so long.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye.